Hi, welcome to this week's program. So maybe you've recently inherited some money. Perhaps a loved one passed away and you've been granted control of the estate, or maybe you were a beneficiary in someone's will. Regardless of the circumstances, you're now sitting on a pile of cash or liquid assets that you want to put to good use. How should you go about investing it, putting that money to work to hopefully bring in more money? One of the most common questions that comes up in this situation is, should I invest the money all at once or spread out my investments over time? As an investment advisor, I have come across this question again and again. So let's take an objective look at it and logically figure out the best course. Now, people who think about gradually investing their money over time often consider a strategy known as dollar cost averaging. Let's call it DCA for short. So what is dollar cost averaging? Dollar cost averaging simply means that you invest a set amount of money at regular intervals, such as monthly. The dollar cost averaging part means that you invest the same amount of money every month or buy the same number of shares every month, regardless of whether your chosen investment, a stock, a mutual fund, or an ETF, is going up or down in price. By doing that, you're basically buying the investment at what the average price is over your investment time frame. Now, part of the appeal of dollar cost averaging is that it's a simple strategy to employ. You're not spending time endlessly analyzing to try to decide, is this a good price to buy this thing? Is it high? Is it low? Is it going up? Is it going down? It's also appealing because it helps you develop the habit of regularly putting money into your investments. But there's a problem with dollar cost averaging. Historically speaking, it doesn't seem to work very well. More than half the time, it turns out that you would have been better off, meaning more profitable, if you'd invested a lump sum all at once. Here's how it works. There are three ways that DCA investing can play out. Let's start with the most favorable scenario. The asset initially falls, but eventually rises in price. You've invested a set amount of money or bought a set amount of shares on a regular scheduled basis in a stock or other asset. During a lot of the time you've been making these regular investments, the asset has been going down in price, so you're feeling pretty smart and everything seems to be going your way. That also means that as the price has gone down, you've bought more and more at a cheaper price, which is pretty good. Now, if at any point in the future the asset's price rises above the highest price you've paid for your shares, then your DCA strategy is going to pay off nicely. So, for example, assume that you bought shares of a stock on a regular monthly investment schedule for a period of 1 year. In the beginning, the price dropped, so let's say your first three buys, you were buying at $100 a share, and then your next buy at 95, and then your next buy at 90. After going down for another 4 months, the asset then starts to rise in price, and your last three buys of that year might be at 95, 100, and 110. So your average cost turns out to be around $89 a share. With the asset currently valued at 110, on average, you're profitable to the tune of about $21 a share. Obviously, that's a more profitable position than if you had just bought all the shares at the same time at a price of 100, which was the market price when you started out. So that's a scenario that worked. But what if the price just keeps dropping and never recovers to a level above your first buy price? In this second possible scenario, sure, you're getting cheaper and cheaper buy-in prices, but the investment basically is a losing one. And by continuing with your DCA strategy, you're really just throwing good money after bad. The final possible scenario for your DCA strategy is one where the asset steadily rises in price from when you first started buying. This sounds good, right? Your investment is obviously making money. However, you missed out on some potential profit because you're paying higher and higher prices for your shares. You'd have done better buying all your shares at once at the very beginning. The best takeaway from considering dollar cost averaging is this. Stock prices and market indexes rise and fall. They go up in price at times, and at other times they go down in price. Therefore, no matter what your investing strategy, one of the most helpful things you can learn is the ability to accept the market's changing fortunes and to realize that you're not always going to buy and sell at the very best price, no matter what strategy you use. However, the evidence of history is very strong that if you follow a solid, well-thought-out investment strategy, the odds are in your favor that over the long run, your investments will prove profitable to you. Now, another aspect to consider when you're thinking about investing all your money at once or spreading out your investments over time is the concept of opportunity cost. Now, opportunity cost simply means that when you commit your money to investment A, well, then you're missing the opportunity to profit from investments B, C, D, and so on. So, for example, if you invest all your inherited wealth in a real estate venture that offers you a possible 10% annual return, which isn't bad, and that's not bad at all, what if that real estate deal isn't a liquid investment, and really most are not? What if it requires you to commit your money for a minimum of 3 years or 5 years? Then what if in just a few months after you invest in that deal, another investment opportunity comes along that would have given you a higher rate of return, maybe 15%? Unfortunately, you can't take advantage of the opportunity because all your investment capital is already tied up in the real estate deal. That's opportunity cost. Taking potential opportunity cost into consideration, you may want to avoid investing all of your money at once, or at least avoid very illiquid investments. Instead, keep some of your money in reserve so that you have money to put into another, better opportunity you might run across in 6 months or a year or so down the road. So in the end, how you invest your money is really up to you. That's the way it should be. You have to decide what your financial goals are, what your risk tolerance is, what your time frame is, so important, and you have to be realistic about what type of returns you can expect to make. Finally, you have to choose what investment strategy you like and are most comfortable with. For some people, investing all your money up front is the way to go. For others, spacing out investments over time and holding some of their cash in reserve will be more appealing. The final decision comes down to you, the investor. And it's good to speak with a financial advisor and other professionals who can help you choose an investment strategy that fits into your overall financial planning and will best serve your personal financial wants and needs. Don't forget that if you're diversifying, not all investments are going to be high at the same time. In that portfolio, there may be low-priced investments as well. So it's another way of kind of catching up and solving this DCA problem. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. If money is the leading cause of divorce, how can you tell if your relationship is headed down that dark path? More specifically, how can you tell if your spouse is cheating on you financially? That's a question many find themselves asking. So let's find out what to look for. My guests are Chris and Marlo Felton, authors of The Prosperity Factor and Couples Money, What Every Couple Should Know About Money and Relationships. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Steve.
Welcome. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
So, you know, you've written that there are seven important signs your spouse or significant other or whatever is financially cheating on you. Number one is when you ask about money, they get defensive. Take us through that a little bit.
Well, you know, that's really important. And that's the number one clue that many people overlook. And when someone's needs aren't being met, they tend to sneak around and do things they shouldn't. And when someone's defensive, that's a telltale sign. Years ago, I like to tell the story of how I was unfaithful financially to my husband. And I have a need of lots of shoes, as my husband knows, right, honey? And
well,
I was purchasing shoes.
You were unfaithful?
Yes, yes. Okay. Financially, honey, just financially.
Oh, okay.
And I was buying shoes because I liked them and I didn't want to tell Chris. And so I hide them in the trunk of my car and I didn't want to talk about it. So avoiding the conversation could just be death to a relationship. We fortunately came up with a good solution and talked it through so I don't have to do that anymore.
So Chris, now that Marlo has, you know, told her tale and come clean, is there anything you want to tell us?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can be uncomfortable, right? And so people avoid, you know, having uncomfortable conversations. And so they just continue to kick the can down the road. My unfaithfulness was just, you know, small spending here and there and happy hours and golf. And, you know, it just, the root of it was we just didn't really know where we were going as a couple. We had no clarity about what we were aiming for. And so, you know, if you don't know where you're going, then just every little shiny object will catch your attention. And that's what was happening to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the point of all of this is to get communication going and to recognize these areas where you may be based out of habit or, you know, just previous life experience. Sometimes it's easier just to avoid confrontation on these issues. All right, let's go to the next one. Financial statements are disappearing if your partner is intercepting the mail before you have a chance to check the payments. I guess something's not right. Do you want to take us through some of that?
Well, yeah, you know, and we really believe that there should be complete financial transparency in a relationship. You know, any spouse that isn't willing to be financially transparent is hiding something, and that's really a warning sign.
I think when you get to that point, tell me if I'm wrong now, but when you get to the point where you're actually taking statements and maybe you're trying to come home early to get the mail, I mean, then something serious is really happening.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, when you're rushing home, that's exactly right. Right. When you're creating that much stress in your life just to hide something, that's when you know you've gone way too far.
When your new best friend's the mailman. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you know the mailman by his first name or her first name, then maybe that's not such a great sign. All right, so the next one is unexpected and unrecognized account activity. You say bring up this topic in a casual way that really asks them more than accuses them. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of what we teach our couples is if you need to have an uncomfortable conversation, we coach them on, you know, hey, Marlo, I want to talk to you about something, but I'm kind of afraid you're going to get mad at me.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, you know, call out the elephant in the room. And so I'm hesitant to talk about it because, you know, I don't want it to get into an argument. And, you know, no, I'm not going to get mad at you. Are you sure? Because I don't want to go there with you. And I don't want to bring it up if it's going to lead to a fight. And so if you do that up front, and yeah, I mean, if you're accusing them, then they're defensive and it's just, you know, it's just a disaster. But, you know, it also means the couple doesn't really have a clear way or a system or a code of honor about how they're going to communicate and bring stuff up. And if they create that ahead of time, because when emotion goes up, intelligence goes down.
Yeah.
So,
good point.
You know, if you create that ahead of time, then, you know, you're going to have a code to kind of follow and a way to have uncomfortable conversations and a system that people will follow through with versus jump into emotion.
Marlo, let me ask you a question. You know, when I was coming up, when I was first married many years ago, we had one bank account. We shared our bank account and checks went into the bank account. But I think couples these days have maybe three bank accounts, one for him, one for her, and maybe a shared bank account. Does this create more tendency towards secrecy, do you think?
Well, it can. But going back to what Chris said is, you know, getting clear on your goals first before you create your segregation system is incredibly important, because then it can avoid the uncomfortable conversation, because you can always go back to, okay, well, we agreed as a couple, this is where we want to be. This is what's important. These are our financial goals. But we do very strongly believe in segregation of funds, which is, I think, what you're referring to, or could be, you know, having the yours, mine, and ours. But it has to be really clear what those accounts are being used for and how much is going into them each month, and that it's equal and agreed upon so that you don't have the siphoning of money from one account, you know, like his account, right? Right, honey? Like if there's more money going in his account and Chris is out playing golf all the time and having great happy hours, I'd be like, what's going on over there?
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be the accountability. But we think that the one checking account system is really asking for trouble for a variety of reasons.
Okay, well, we don't have time to get into that, but that is an interesting point. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that at some future time. I guess what you guys are saying is that obviously a relationship needs to be built on trust. And, you know, you're human and have a lot of emotional characteristics to their personalities. So sometimes that trust gets eroded. Here's one that I like. Your partner has new possessions, shoes, and experiences not involving you. Be wary of all your partner's new items, how they were obtained, if they were obtained with a great deal, quote unquote. Also, take note if your spouse's new hobbies are addictive activities like gambling or playing the lottery excessively. That could, of course, take a toll on bank accounts. And I think, you know, drugs and alcoholism comes in here. You know, this whole idea of you hiding your shoes in the trunk, you know, is kind of reminiscent of the alcoholic who's kind of hiding the bottle.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really just the root of much more, you know, deeper problems.
Absolutely. Chris, you want to weigh in on this at all?
Yeah. I mean, I just kind of going previously, just, you know, our separate fund accounts, you know, just a set amount that her and I get every month, and it's the same. And, you know, once again, that's under the umbrella of, you know, one or two major financial goals that we have. And we're really clear on, hey, here's the reasons why we want it to happen. You know, here's the emotional reasons why we want to have these goals happen. And when we have that buy-in up front, but also having funds set aside or you'll self-sabotage the plan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when that amount is spent every month, it's gone. And if we're clear on the major goals, then, you know, we're okay with that. So go have fun. Allocate money for fun. Do with it what you want. Buy what you want. But when it's gone, it's gone. You're not getting, you know, any more. So that's been super, super helpful for us and the people we coach.
Well, that's good advice. We are out of time. My guests are Chris and Marlo Felton, and author of Couples Money, What Every Couple Should Know About Money and Relationships. And you can find them at couplesmoney.com, couplesmoney.com. And to find out more about Marlo and Chris Felton and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners. And I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com. And contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. With the new digital age ever encroaching into our lives, even the art market is changing rapidly as baby boomers age and then begin to deaccumulate their art. Millennials are right behind them, snapping it up in their own unique fashion. To take us into this new art world and its ever-changing landscape, Peter Lowry joins me. Peter is recognized as being the most experienced modern art and design specialist in the auction house industry. He's the director of modern design and fine art at Los Angeles Modern Auctions. And also, you may know him because he happens to moonlight as the modern art authority on PBS's Antique Roadshow. Hey, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve.
So give us some historical context. When did you start in the industry and what was it like back then?
Well, actually, I started very early, almost as a kid. I was 18 and just out of high school, and my older brother had developed a business of selling mid-century modern furniture and 20th century icons of popular culture. Mm-hmm. So I joined him as kind of an intern. And by the time I was 20, I was already developing a kind of a sense of connoisseurship about works made in the 20th century.
So you were initially involved in furniture, right? And you started your own gallery or your own store, right?
Yeah, our original passion was objects. Furniture was a big part of it, but we also sold glass and ceramics and books and jewelry and anything that was made by a 20th century artist or craftsperson that were rejecting classicism and taking avant-garde practices into their medium.
So what, did you eventually sell that business and move into another area of the art world? How did that transition?
No, actually, it's just kind of morphed into a more developed art model. The buyers today are completely different than the buyers back then.
Yeah.
I used to sell to enthusiasts, people who just wanted to surround themselves with these interesting objects and including works of art. But today people are looking more at these objects in the context of investment, as well as nice objects to surround themselves with.
Yeah, I want to get into that, the difference between the baby boomer buying art and, let's say, the millennial market. So baby boomers are more apt to collect for aesthetic reasons, because I guess we're, in a sense, I'm a baby boomer, you know, we were used to buying and having objects, and if they're objects of great beauty, surrounding ourselves with them, as you've said. Millennials have a kind of a different attitude, I think. Maybe they're more into the experience of things rather than owning things. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I wanted to kind of get that conversation started and see if I'm going down the right path.
Yeah, I think when I started in the mid-80s, I was selling mostly to baby boomers, and they really did want to have an aesthetic experience of sort of acquiring pieces, becoming what they perceived as being a modern day collector of objects that you can use as well as just objects, you know, to surround yourself to enhance your daily life. And over the years, that's kind of morphed, because a lot of this material that was very inexpensive at the time has gone up in value. And you really can't ignore the fact that when you're buying these pieces today, it is an investment.
Yeah.
Investment, because it's one of the biggest, you know, reasons to make a decision. You know, am I going to really buy this dining table that's $45,000 today? Because that's a significant investment. So it's going to take an investment to acquire these pieces today. So you really have to be more cautious and more thoughtful about what you're buying, to make sure that you're buying the works that are continuing to hold their value.
Well, you know, when you're younger and you don't really have the wherewithal to spend a lot of money, then it's kind of art for art's sake, is because you like it. But, you know, if that table was $1,000 30 years ago and now it's at $45,000 and you're going in there going, I'm going to spend $45,000 on this dining room table, you know, there better be another element, or at least question you ask yourself, you know, what is the value of this thing going to be in the future, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, because a more significant portion of your funds are going towards these purchases today, I think. So you have to be cautious and make sure that you're making a wise decision.
One of your ideas that you've written about is one where you think baby boomers, and I mentioned this a little bit in the intro, will be deaccumulating their art over the next 20 years. You think kind of the baby boomers, in a sense, will be out of the art market, and the art market has changed, or the collective psychology has changed, because in other generations, a lot of this art would have been passed down through inheritances, but that may no longer be the case. Can you explain that to us?
So the baby boomers now have been collecting for over 30 years. And if you imagine the arc of a collector, they start collecting when they're in their 30s and 40s. And at some point, those collections need to be disseminated. In the earlier eras, these works were just passed down through the family, like you mentioned, as sort of heirlooms. But today we're seeing collectors and their offspring, you know, have different ideas of what they want to keep and what they want to sell. And sometimes these pieces have gone up so much in value that it really is a strong consideration to consider the financial value of these works. And so I think we're seeing more baby boomers starting to sell now as they get to that age where transition of their collection is going to be more popular rather than keeping these works together as collections.
Yeah, I guess the idea is that, you know, if in fact you've been fortunate enough to own this art and it's now appreciated greatly, you're going to ask yourself the question, you know, why don't I just sell it now and get the benefit from the value of these things to diversify my financial holdings, maybe do some of the things that I want to do, not knowing, first of all, what the value of this art's going to be, you know, decades from now as tastes and fashion shifts. And maybe the kids really just don't really care for the art anyway, because they have their own sense of style. So if in fact baby boomers are going to be selling off, you know, their art into the marketplace, where are the opportunity for investors there? Because I love to see something that's almost a significant long-term trend. It seems like you could make some investment plans to take that opportunity on that.
Well, I think one important thing that exists now that didn't exist 30 years ago when I started is the readily transfer of information. It's just so much easier to understand what things are worth now than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
30 years ago, you really needed to go to an expert, and the expert tended to keep the information to themselves. It wasn't in a dealer's best interest to share that information. So you really never were sure about what something was worth 30 years ago. You only could find out by asking what a dealer was charging for it. Mm-hmm. Today, information is so easy to exchange that almost anyone now can look up the value of works that they're collecting. And there's a whole network of dealers like myself who will share that information for free and very quickly. So that is actually a unique distinction about the market today as opposed to 30 years ago. And that gives people the option of understanding what things are worth almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Almost like you would look up your stock portfolio, you can now look up your art collection portfolio.
Yeah, so there's all this greater transparency, which is a very, very positive outcome of the digital age. I mean, I have personally have bought items online through various auction sites and been very, very happy with the idea that I can buy a David Hockney, who's one of my favorite artists, and know that, you know, it's the real thing, and then have it delivered and then have it framed and have it up in my home. I don't think I really would have done that because I'm a, you know, kind of a low level collector. I wouldn't have done that necessarily 25 or 30 years ago. It would have taken a lot more effort for me to go and start shopping dealers and understanding the market. And as you say, they would keep the information close to the vest. So let's talk about digital. By the way, I'm speaking with Peter Lowry. He is the Director of Modern Design and Fine Art at Los Angeles Modern Auctions. And you may know him because he also moonlights as the modern art authority on PBS's Antique Roadshow. So, Peter, how much has the digital world changed the art market? And tell us now where millennials are headed in this area.
So the digital world has turned the art world upside down. 30 years ago, it was very difficult to get information as a collector. Today, it's very easy. And that means you can be sure of what you're buying, that it's authentic, for example, or B, what it really is worth. You can find out things like prints and multiples and objects that are not unique but made in multiple. You can find out what other examples have sold for mm-hmm. very easily and very quickly. So you can understand, well, if the last one sold for X, then I feel comfortable paying X for this one.
Yeah.
And that presents the marketplace with a kind of a credible market value that was not seen in previous generations.
Right. So what are millennials buying these days?
So, well, I'm seeing a large group of millennials coming into our auction galleries, and they are looking for investment quality 20th century art and design. And that means that they have a taste for modernism and for contemporary art periods and movements, but they're focusing more on the pieces that have the most value-oriented backgrounds.
What does that mean? Give me an example of that.
If you had a Venn diagram of a circle of all of the things that you like and another circle of all of the things that have tradable reproducible value, mm-hmm. and you overlap them in some way, you know, where they overlap is where you should be focusing on. That's the advice I give young collectors. Find pieces that you like that are also holding their value and consistently tradable.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Peter Lowry is with me. You can find him at lamodern.com. Hey, Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
To hear this conversation again, to find out more about Peter and what he has to say about the art market, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thank you, Steve. Look forward to being here with you.
Terry, so inventory, we're always talking about inventory, and inventory is getting tighter and tighter,
tighter. It's like choking us. We talk about the canary in the coal mine.
What is the canary in the coal mine in the real estate
business
right now?
So in the real estate world, what we're talking about is historically low mortgage interest rates, increased buyer demand. So what that's doing is just choking the market where we have less inventory, lower levels of inventory, especially in the lower price range, in the mid price range.
What are those numbers? What is lower?
Well, they will tell you, and this is national numbers, so under 200 would be low. And then 2 to 7, they consider mid on a national level.
Yeah.
So we're seeing downward pressure also on that mid. And it's truly because interest rates are extremely attractive and demand is still there.
Yeah. So it's a basic supply and demand situation.
Absolutely.
Less supply, greater demand means higher prices. But have we started to really see prices bump here?
Well, you know, what we saw was actually in the beginning of the year, we thought we were like slipping into a shift. I'll call it a shift.
From growth
to contraction or mm-hmm. growth to stability.
Yeah.
We did actually see it because hindsight shows that we saw that. But then the interest rates dropped and it happened because the interest rates started to climb.
That's right. They did. Right? Actually, pretty significantly in the fourth quarter of 2018, they climbed pretty dramatically.
Correct. We saw that effect.
Rates got to 5%.
Correct.
For mortgage. Now they're under 4% again.
Right.
And they're slow to react. You know, the rates are based on the yield of the 10-year treasury.
Okay.
Mostly.
Right.
And that yield can bounce around quite a bit. It was up to 2%. It was up 2.5%. It's now down to 1.5%. But yeah. Mortgage rates are like, they're stuck in the mud. They take a much longer time to adjust downward. And so watch for the rates on the 10-year. Maybe the 2-year treasury is fine as well. But do not look at overnight rates. Do not look at what the Fed funds rate or anything
right.
like that, because that's a very volatile rate. A lot of guessing there and a lot of just supply and demand on a short-term basis for money overnight. Long story short, if you're looking at mortgage rates, go online, ask what the yield on the 10-year is. And chart that and you'll see where things are.
And you know, interesting, Steve, some people say to me, oh, I'm going to wait to buy because prices have gotten too high. You know, if you look at the purchase prices, they are up there.
Yeah.
I mean, we peaked. And so many buyers will say, well, I think I'm going to wait. And I'm like, well, what are you waiting for? Because interest rates are so low.
Yeah, it's not price, it's affordability.
Yes.
We've talked about that a lot.
Yep.
If you had 10% interest rates and you could only afford a $250,000 house.
Right.
At 5%, you could probably afford a $500,000 house.
Exactly.
That's why stock prices are high. Interest rates act as a form of gravity. When interest rates are low, it's low gravity. Asset prices rise.
Right. So it's cheaper to buy a more expensive house at a lower interest rate
yes.
than it is to buy a house at a lower purchase price at a higher interest rate.
Right.
So there's an inverse relationship. So
that's right.
Pay attention to the interest rates. That's what you should be following.
Well, just the cost.
It's the cost to purchase.
And within your budget, make sure it stays within your
Absolutely.
Budget.
Absolutely.
In 2013, I bought a home mm-hmm. in Delray Beach.
Yep.
And I had never paid that much for a home. And it wasn't expensive. I'm not saying it was like a, you know, big mansion or anything. Far from it. But I had never paid that much. But when I did the math, I got like a, my mortgage was like 3 3/4. It's like, oh, this is affordable.
Oh, I could do it.
I could do it and I paid for it. And I'm so happy that I did that.
Yeah.
I didn't wait. What would I be waiting for anyway?
Right.
All right. So are you seeing bidding wars still? I mean, the average home is, according to the statistics here, in August, the average home sold with an average of 3 offers. What about in the local market?
Well, in the local market, we do still see bidding wars. I actually just had one. It was a low-priced condo. I had 4 offers on it. Interestingly enough, nobody went over asking. So
okay.
My price was attractive enough to make 4 offers. The winning bid was $2,500 below asking. So yes, there was still bidding wars. And truly, if it's priced more aggressively, you can actually bid up over asking.
Well, we used to say that about 6 months ago or 9 months ago, you were saying that as a tactic. I think that kind of softened up a little bit. But if the price is right. Now, of those 4, or the person that won, was cash a consideration?
Believe it or not, of the 4, 1 was cash, and that was the lowest offer.
Oh.
So we didn't even consider
That's interesting. Yep. All right, we talked a little bit about interest rates and why they move, so I don't think we have to really talk about that. But I think interest rates are, we know for sure they're below 4%, 3 3/4, 3.5. If you have a 15-year loan, you're in the low 3s,
right,
which is pretty cool. But of course, don't forget your monthly payment is higher because you're amortizing over half the period.
Right. And if you can do a 15-year mortgage, do it.
Yeah. Well,
I think so.
Yeah,
if you can afford to do it.
If you can afford to do it.
I don't know.
Or put an extra payment down
once
a year, and that covers almost the same
thing. I think it's 18 years instead of 15 years.
The problem is that people who say they're going to do that never do that.
Yep.
So the idea about wealth creation with homes is that it's forced savings because you're going to pay your mortgage. You got to live somewhere. You got to pay the monthly VIG, right?
Right.
And in that VIG, you're paying down principal, and that's creating some wealth for you. And that's why people's homes are very important.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Most expensive asset most people have.
All right. We only have about a minute and a half left, but I saw an article about what buyers should not be asking sellers to do. And I just want to start this off with my favorite.
Sure.
If the repair item is under $100. You know what? Don't ask. Go ahead. You take it from there.
Yeah, folks, listen. Your inspector's out there to find things wrong with the house. You've paid him to find things wrong with the house. Every house has a load of little things wrong.
Yes. Switch plates.
You name it. You've got it.
Yeah.
Don't even go there.
You know, a baseboard that's got a stain on it.
Right. A little crack in it. A lot of cosmetic.
Cosmetic. Even spider cracks, in the driveway or something.
A hole in the screen. That's another real popular one. It's like a bird hit it and his beak went through it.
Also, however, if the crack is greater than 1/4 inch, then you may have a structural thing going
on. Yeah.
So you should probably explore that a little bit more. Well, we have to stop here. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. Andrew Gross is the author of the international bestseller The Blue Zone, Don't Look Twice in the Dark Tide, which was nominated for the Best Thriller of the Year award by the International Thriller Writers. Reckless, Eyes Wide Open, One Mile Under, The One Man, and The Saboteur. He's also known because he's the co-author of 5 number one bestsellers with James Patterson, including Judge and Jury and Lifeguard. Now, I've asked him to join me today to talk about his new book, the name of which is Button Man, and it said it's kind of a cross of between Great Expectations meets The Godfather. So, sounds pretty interesting. But as always, I'm interested in how the business of publishing works, and I've asked Andrew if he would talk about publishing business as well. I know there's a lot of writers out there who want to understand some of the mysteries of the business. Andrew Gross, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be with you.
So let's start with your new book. Button Man is the name, and it's the story of an immigrant family that's in New York City, the vibrant New York City around 1920s, 1930s. Give us a good synopsis of it.
I'll give you a sentence or two, because it's always, especially when it comes to a thriller, you don't want to give too much away, but it does sort of breach the era between 1905 and 1935, starting on the Lower East Side of New York. And it's the story of Morris Robb, who's a rough and tumble kid who grows up on the Lower East Side and has to begin work at 12 years old, has to leave the fifth grade in order to help support his family, ends up apprenticing in a garment factory. And by the time he's 19, he's running that factory and ultimately opens his own firm and has to go head to head against the Jewish mob, which is probably worth talking about a little bit.
Sure.
Who have taken over the garment unions for their own gain and are extorting and murdering people who don't comply with how they want to run it.
There's 3 brothers. There's Morris, Saul, and Harry. Mm-hmm. And Saul becomes an accountant. Harry falls in with the gang. And I guess that's where really the big tension lies, is they are brother against brother at some point.
Yeah, it is the story of 3 brothers, the Rabashevsky brothers, whose name gets shortened to Rob.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, you know, one of them is Saul, sort of heady and level-headed, and he has to drop out of accounting school, and he joins his younger brother in business. And the third brother, Harry, who is scarred by a family tragedy, ends up being seduced into a life of crime. And even though he's never a bad guy, he's always hanging around with bad guys, and you can sort of see the impending tragedy of what's going to take place by him. You know, one of the things about the book is you see this collision that's about to take place ultimately between Morris, who is a person of this unshakable moral center, and Louis Buchalter, who becomes Louis Lepke, famous mobster, famous Jewish mobster.
Ruthless mobster.
Who he's known since his early years on the Lower East Side, and who ultimately, you know, are going to end up face to face in a confrontation.
So I know that your family was a big part of the garment trade, and Button Man is about that. Is much of this autobiographical?
It is. I actually set out to write my grandfather's story.
Mm-hmm.
And he was that person who quit school at 12 and ended up, before he was 20, ended up running the company he apprenticed in, and then did square off against the forces of organized crime. My grandfather was a man who, until the day he died, would be happy to lift his shirt and show you the stab wounds that he carried his whole life, courtesy of Louis Lepke's henchman, whose name was Garah, Jacob Shapiro, known as Garah. And at the time, early on, the unions were corrupt. So it took a certain kind of person to stand up to them. And
very much.
Whether or not ultimately my grandfather was the most successful, I mean, he built a large company and ended up being on the New York Stock Exchange, and he did rather well in life. But even more than that, any of his contemporaries would tell you that he was the toughest SOB of any of them. So I did set out to write his story.
Yeah, that's a great story. Well, there's some threads between this story and your family and my family a little bit. My father was in the garment business. He was a salesman. He sold women's clothes down here in South Florida for many years, as well as New York. My last name is Pomerantz. The founder of the company you're talking about was...
Yeah, my family name is Pomerantz.
Pomerantz, too, exactly. Now, of course, you have a T, and as I always tell my listeners, there's no T in my Pomerantz.
There's no,
Huh. When you go to the website.
We usually encounter Pomerances occasionally with CE, and I go, no, we're the Jewish Pomerances.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there is that. I don't think my father was involved in any of this type of thing at all. But so your grandfather started the company Leslie Fay, am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was the company he took public. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, depending on how old your listeners are, they would know it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our company, especially since your listeners, I think, have a financial interest, was one of the first of the CEO scandals. It ended up having an $80 million overstatement of income in 1993, I believe, and ended up running through its covenants and going Chapter 11. When I left the firm, I used to work with it before I started writing. It was doing close to $1 billion when $1 billion was $1 billion, and eventually it just shrunk down to nothing and became delisted.
Right. You talk about when you started writing, so you were in that business and you got out of that business, and one of your first gigs was writing with James Patterson. How did that come about?
Well, after I left our family company, I ended up doing turnarounds in the sports apparel field, like Head Skis, Head Tennis, which was a big one, and a couple of others. And one of them didn't turn around. So I came home one day without a role in life. And my wife said, you know, what are we going to do, having, you know, three kids in private school and living that sort of life? Yeah. And I looked at her and I said, we're going to write a novel. And, you know, unbeknownst to her, I'd been noodling this idea around for a thriller. And in any case, I said, give me a year, you know. Mm-hmm. So the year turned into 3 years, and ultimately I was drifting farther away than anything I knew how to do in life. But I had this book, and in the end, the book got rejected by 27 publishers.
Wow.
And I had no idea what I was going to do in life, sort of having already driven my family off the cliff to do this for 3 years.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, I got a call, and someone said, could you take a call from James Patterson?
Mm.
And keeping in mind, something like 16, 17 years ago, Patterson wasn't quite the person, the big business force that he is today, but he was still a number one author. And as far as I'm concerned, the fact that, you know, he had somehow read my book, it had been given to him by the president of Little Brown, his publisher.
Okay.
And he said, basically, you got the goods. Would you like to meet?
Wow.
So we met in White Plains at a diner in White Plains. And he proposed this idea he had of a new series other than his Alex Cross series. And I became his first co-author. Now he's got plenty of them. And of course, he's bringing out 8 to 10 books a year, even more. But going back, I was his first. And, you know, he wanted to do a brand extension into these four women crime fighters.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up setting it in San Francisco and do another series. And it was sort of a radical idea back then. At this point, a lot of the, you know, the large branded authors are augmenting their own work with the work of co-authors.
I have a question about the role of the co-author. You know, it made me think of the composer John Williams, you know, Star Wars and all of these great Spielberg movies. And from what I understand, you know, he writes the themes, the emotional inflection points, some of the voicings on it. And then there's other people who actually fill in the blanks. Is that the role of a co-author? How does that actually work?
Well, I don't know. You know, it depends, and I can't speak to how everybody works, but I would think more like Dick Wolf as a creator of content, and individual people would write the episodes, and or even Rembrandt, or sort of the school of Rembrandt, although I don't want to overstate it artistically. But, you know, I will say just in a sentence that when I was working with Jim, every book I did with him came from his idea and his original outline. And, you know, I mean, my role was to take that outline and maybe, you know, stretch it out into a full novel. And then, you know, you can usually assume that the person who's below the line is perhaps writing, you know, doing a lot of the day-to-day work. And but I will also say that Jim also had last draft on all of the things that we did together, and things could change in that last draft as well. So, you know, it was a collaboration. I was happy to do it. It got me a strong platform, you know, when I started working on my own, and in the sense that I had bestseller status, because ultimately I went from no name to equal billing on 3 or 4 books and developed a sort of a branding of my own at that point. And so when I went on my own, publishers sort of looked at me as someone who could have bestseller status.
Yeah. My guest is Andrew Gross. We're talking about his new book, Button Man, about the garment industry. And we're also talking about the business of publishing and things like that. So that phone call, lightning struck for you, lucky man. And, you know, it's interesting because a couple of years ago, I interviewed Winston Groom, the author of Forrest Gump. And he had a similar experience. You know, he kind of hung around with the mucky mucks up in New York State or on the island somewhere. And, you know, he started writing and he presented his books to some of them and they encouraged him. And next thing you know, he gets a call from an editor and lightning struck for him. So I asked him about editors and about that experience. And he said, you know, most editors are not editors anymore. They're book buyers. Is that true in your case? Do you feel the same way?
Well, the role is different. I mean, this is not Maxwell Perkins and F. Scott Fitzgerald anymore. I mean, you know, in my case, editors are sort of custodians of the book. Once, you know, yes, they're book buyers, and then they are custodians in the publishing process. So they basically get your book through all the aspects of publication. Now, there is a little editing to it, and depending on who your editor is, it's more or less of that. The most important thing that I rely on my editor for are to resolve the big macro issues in a book, the motivations, whether it achieves suspense,
I see,
whether the characters are believable, but at the same time, they have over time evolved sort of into business people as much as literary people.
Yeah. So look, the publishing industry has dramatically changed over the last 10, 15 years. There's a lot of self-publishing now. Have you ever done the self-publishing thing, or have you been in traditional publishing because of your start with Jim
Patterson? I've been in traditional publishing, and I mean, I have to admit that I've never actually earned a royalty other than on foreign rights, because, you know, the sort of the thing is, if you're earning royalties, your agent didn't do a good enough job for you. And I suppose that I have always been part of a legacy publishing business.
Mm-hmm.
There are these breakout stories of people who succeed in self-publishing, but it's a very difficult process. You might even get one book that sells well. It's hard to follow that up the way that it is in publishing, where, you know, you have someone who's responsible for sort of building a brand. You're on your own in self-publishing. So even if you get sort of a breakout book, there's no guarantee that whether it's Amazon or whoever will turn that into a career for you.
Yeah.
So it's really a long shot. I mean, it's a long shot even in regular publishing at this point. It's an industry that's stacked against in a big way, but self-publishing is even more so. And the fact of the matter is, there's good and bad in self-publishing quickly. The good is that people who were storytellers and for whatever reason couldn't get their stories to market have a chance to do so. So that's nice.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, it just puts an awful lot of clutter out there in the publishing universe, an awful lot of inventory, a lot of mediocre inventory at best, and everybody's reading a little piece of it. So it sort of takes away from the market as well.
I think clutter describes everything that has happened to us because of the explosion online, whether it's news, whether it's music. I mean, there's just so much of it out there. It's really hard to kind of filter it all down and find kind of the best of the best. And I think that's
where the
traditional publishing did its job. You know, it is said that if you're lucky, you may have one good novel. If you're extremely lucky, you may have two. You've had many more than two. Are you lucky? Are you talented? What's the story?
Well, I am lucky in that my book could have easily been rejected, and I don't know what industry I'd be in now were it not for whatever hands put it in Jim Patterson. So I am lucky.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there is a nexus between luck and skill, and so I think I bring something to the table. I do write historical novels at this point, not just thrillers.
I wanted to ask
historical
you,
thrillers.
Yeah, you've changed your mode here. You've got a new publisher, I understand, and now you've written this kind of historical novel about your family called Button Man we're talking about. Are you going to be moving into this area specifically now?
No, I have. This is my fourth book that's historically set. My first was a story of my wife's family called The One Man, which was set, a lot of it set in Auschwitz. It was his Holocaust story and received a lot of attention. So The One Man, and now this one is really based on my family story, but it's still a thriller at heart and a story, you know, set in the 20s and 30s in New York and in a subject that is, you know, it could be very interesting to people because I'm not sure how much know about the Jewish mob, but you know, in the day, the Jewish mob was a lot bloodier than the Italian mob. As a matter of fact, the Italian mob used to farm out its hits to the Jewish mob, who turned it into a business for hire, hence the name Murder Incorporated.
So
this is sort of the terrain that I'm in now of this time period. And I sort of do like writing books now that have a lot more atmosphere, a lot more historical setting, and the outcome of the book impacts how history goes as well. So to me, it's a richer theme to be mining.
I don't think we've heard a lot about the Jewish mafia, so I think that would be a good track. My guest, Andrew Gross, the book is Button Manned. He has written many books and also co-authored with James Patterson. Remember, folks, to hear this in any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website, stevepomerantz.com. No T in Pomerantz, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown on the important topics we've covered that week, straight to your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Andrew, thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
You bet. My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com, and contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.